Hello and welcome to another edition of Positive Leadership, the podcast that helps you grow as an individual, a leader, and ultimately as a global citizen. Humans create more than 400 million metric tons of plastic every year. Around 1 million tons of that plastic ends up in the ocean. Swirling ocean currents gather some of it into huge garbage patches, like the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, which is three times the size of my country, France. Roughly 800 species are impacted by plastic pollution in the ocean. And the economic impact is estimated at being up to $19 billion per year.
I think for a few billion dollars, we can solve all the plastic emissions and the legacy in the ocean. So compared to an issue like climate, I mean, that's many orders of magnitude more costly, right, to do that. So if we can keep things simple, I think that would be helpful.
Boyan Slat, my guest today, is a Dutch inventor, an entrepreneur passionate about creating mega projects to address planetary problems. In 2013, at just 18 years old, he dropped out of university to found the Ocean Cleanup, a nonprofit organization dedicated to developing advanced technologies to rid the world's oceans of plastic. I was so excited to have Boyan on the podcast to find out how close he's got to achieving that incredible goal and how he's mobilized so many people to get behind his cause. The result is a fascinating listen. I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. There's a lot of practical take-home advice that you can build into your own leadership practice. Make sure you stay with us until the very end. So, Boyan, it's been, I think, 10 years since you launched. And this year could prove to be momentous. You're only weeks away from launching the largest iteration of your ocean cleaning system, System 3. So how is that going? And are you still on track with that?
Yeah, it's been 10 years indeed since we started the ocean cleanup. I'm getting old, yeah. It's like
not really pain
and things like that. But no, it seems like this year it's essentially the year that things are coming together. Of course, first few years was all about doing the research, understanding the problem. And yep. Once we had that, we started going to the prototyping, developing the technology. And 2 years ago, we came to the point that we actually had technologies that, mm-hmm. that worked. So yep. We had systems in rivers to catch plastic before it flowed into the oceans. We had a system in the Great Pacific Garbage Patch collecting plastic at a large scale. But having something that works is not the same as being ready for scale up and being able to roll this out around the world. So there's this maturization phase that we're in right now to optimize the technology, reduce the cost, and indeed now on rivers, it's about completing those first 20 rivers, the first mm-hmm. 20 projects that we have to ensure that they work pretty smoothly, that we don't lose any plastic, that they are financially self-sustaining as well. And then in the ocean, in the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, where you have this legacy pollution, the plastic that does not go away by itself mm-hmm. anymore, there we are launching System 3 this summer, which is sort of our first full-scale ocean cleanup system. And the thing is, the bigger you go, the more effective you can be in your cleanup. So size really does matter for ocean cleanup systems. So it's all about making it big. We're now at about 1,800 meters. We want to go to about 2.5 kilometers in length. So, I mean, already it's the longest thing ever deployed on the ocean.
Huge.
When we get there, we will be cleaning up a football field of ocean every 5 seconds, approximately. So that's how big the system is. So, things are kind of coming together this summer, for sure.
Pretty amazing to see what has been accomplished in 10 years. But could you unpack a little bit, actually, what it looked like with System 1 and then going from System 1 to System 2? Just to really unpack the underlying technology, what have been the key blockers, the key kind of insights discovered? Because I know you had some ups and downs. It was not like an easy journey at all.
Yeah.
So can you explain again to our listeners, what does the technology achieve and what was again a main breakthrough you were able to achieve the last 10 years?
There is no sort of manual on how to build an ocean cleanup system, right? So it's a completely new category of technology that we had to start from scratch on. And the way I'd like to think about concepting and innovation is like a landscape of hills and mountains, right? And by optimizing, by developing, you're essentially climbing up a hill.
Yeah.
But when you're on that hill, you don't know whether you're on the hill of sort of an Appalachian mountain or on Mount Everest, right? So sometimes you end up with this local optimum, and you have to decide, okay, am I still going to try and optimize my current hill? Am I keep going to climb that hill that I'm on, or am I going to
reset
start from scratch and go back to the drawing board? So we had a few of those moments through our history. Initially, the idea was to have this passive system because we thought, if we can use the force of nature to do this, that would be that would be great. It'd save money, save time. So we had this long floating barrier. 2018, we launched that from San Francisco to the patch. We deployed it, and the first issue we had was that we weren't collecting plastic, which of course is pretty important for an ocean cleanup system. And then secondly, a few months later, we had a structural failure of the system due to fatigue. And that actually forced us quite dramatically to go back to the drawing board. So that experiment had cost us millions of dollars, year and a half of development. It was just very painful to struggle to get everyone and everything back to land safely. Of course, the media was all over it to say, like, okay, see, told you so. The experts claimed that it was never going to work, and indeed it failed. Yeah, so that was difficult. But fortunately, we still had just enough money on the bank for one more try. And then we went back out there, deployed again. And this time, we did manage to get it to work.
To make it work.
But then still, what we found was that the system, even though it was collecting plastic, it wasn't doing it at the scale we would need to be able to clean up the whole patch. We're not in the business to clean up a bit of plastic. We're here to solve the problem. So so then again, we decided to jump to another foot of another mountain, and third time was a charm, really, when we decided to go active, to actually pull the system forth, which had two main advantages. Firstly, the amount of surface area that you cover is much greater, so you can collect more plastic. But secondly, you can steer the cleanup system to where you want to be, and that was, I think, the main breakthrough there, that we discovered that this patch is not homogeneous. So you have these hot spots where there is a way higher concentration of plastic. So I would say our current cleanup approach is this merging of both hardware and software. Yes, it's about having a really big system and making that work. But at the same time, it's about really having this targeted approach, having these computer models that we run all the time to actually run these forecasts on, in the next 2 days, you have to be at this coordinates to collect your plastic.
Listening to Bojan talk about the way he's developed and refined his cleanup approach over time, or he stayed focused on achieving his goal, evolving himself and his team as he went through those mountains and valleys, is truly inspiring. And it says a lot about the strength of his mindset. Ever since he was a child, Bojan loved inventing and making things like tree houses and zip lines with his friends. And as he got older, he started working on harder projects like homemade rockets, and he began tinkering with computers. He even broke a Guinness World Record at age 14 when he launched 213 water rockets, the most ever set off at one time. So Bojan, you've said before that you've always been fascinated by working out or to do things that other people think are impossible. Hmm. So can you tell me about where this passion for tackling things, fixing things comes from? Is it from your parents?
Sure. I think it's probably more genetic than the nurture, I would say. Okay. So we have a parents, of course, I love them, but they're not scientists, they're not engineers. My father is, I would say, very creative. He's an artist, he's a painter. Mm-hmm. So maybe to me, solving problems is an art form as well. It's very much a creative endeavor. But I don't know, like recently I found a VHS tape of some sort of early recordings of my life when I was one or two. And and this is video of me just playing with the buttons of a washing machine. And my dad says, like, oh, he'll be very technical in the future. And so, well, that's quite prophetic, I would say. Already when I was 2 years old, I wanted to build my own chair. So family member that was a carpenter got me some materials and I built my own chair.
Two years old.
Yeah. It wasn't very good looking, but
it's okay.
It was functional. And then, I got into building computers, got into building explosives probably when I was 8 or 9. So I love chemistry and doing experiments in that avenue. And then, water rockets became my obsession. Mm. So they're these pressurized things that you can shoot up in the air, and thought, okay, how far can I take this? So I thought, okay, let's try and set a Guinness World Record to launch as many of them as possible at the same time. And I suppose that was my first project that was bigger than just one person. I had to mobilize 300 people to launch one of those things at the same time. I had companies involved for sponsorship. There was media that was covering this thing. So so my first real project, and indeed I set the record then. It wasn't very useful, but it kept me busy as a child, for sure.
And obviously it showed your entrepreneurship mindset already, right? When you're 40 years old, basically, right? Mobilizing people, I mean, getting money, getting support, and actually making it work as well, of course.
Yeah, to me, having an idea and then seeing that become reality, there's no better feeling in the world than that. So for me, that is what keeps me going through all the unscheduled learning opportunities that we have come across over the years.
That's what we call in a podcast, of course, an incredible growth mindset, right? So always having the appetite to learn new things, and I'm sure you keep doing the same. So the problem of plastic pollution, we know, is enormous, and the longer the plastic stays in the ocean, the harder it is to clean up, as it breaks down into microplastic particles. And I understand, of course, it becomes legendary now that you first became aware of it when you went on diving holiday, right, in Greece, in the blue waters of Greece when you were 16. Uh-huh. So can you tell us more about that experience and how it triggered your own personal transformation, if that was actually the key moment to create your vocation, to clean up the ocean?
It's indeed scuba diving in Greece. Mm-hmm. I was about to get my license and I was hoping to see all these beautiful things underwater. And instead, I looked around me and saw more plastic bags than fish. And I was quite disappointed by that. But rather than sort of sitting around and feeling sad about it, sort of my sort of engineering mind just quickly went to, okay, so how do we solve this, right? How do we fix this? And that provided me the opportunity to combine this passion I had for technology with some actually useful cause.
That's a very special moment, I'm sure, in your life. But they might you might have gone as well through some other moments of truth that shape you, right? As as an individual, and I would say as a leader, as a change maker, and helping you shaping your mission as well. So was there another moment when you decided, okay, this is kind of, I don't know if it's a mission of your life, but at least for the last 10 years, I guess it's been your entire life dedicated to that, right? Isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No time for anything else. So I suppose if you look for sort of concrete, pivotal moments, I would say the moment that I dropped out of university was, I think, quite an important moment when this idea was stuck in my head. I couldn't stop thinking about it.
It was an obsession.
Obsessed about it. Yeah. So, and then I came to the moment that I realized, okay, if I really want to give this a try and I want to give this any probability of success, I should probably dedicate all my time to this.
And your parents were supportive of that, Boyan, or they were a bit shocked, or they said, "No, that's good, my son. Let's do that."
So, the one thing I'm incredibly thankful of, especially for my mom, because I grew up with her. My parents divorced at a very young age. Is that she's always given me the encouragement and the space to follow my curiosity and my passion. Yep. My childhood was just this long chain of obsessions, and whenever I had a new obsession, she would buy me books, the books that I was looking for to understand these things. I was always allowed to use the living room as my workshop, my
the
lab.
Laboratory, the lab, yeah.
Like when I told her that I was contemplating this, contemplating to drop out, she asked me, "Okay, well, have you thought about this? Are you sure?" And I say, "Yeah, I think it's the cost benefit analysis makes sense." And then she said, "Okay, well, go ahead."
Having the backing and support of his mom when he was thinking of dropping out of university was critical for Boyan. But it's something that Bill Drayton talks about extensively in his episode, how important it is to encourage young people in their passions, to give them space to forge their own entrepreneurial paths, and how, when you do that, they can go on to do the most extraordinary things. A couple of months before he decided to drop out of university, Boyan gave a TEDx talk in which he described the initial concept of cleaning the oceans. At the time, he had something like $300 saved up to launch a project. He needed lots more money to get it off the ground, but initially there was not much attention. Then in April 2013, the video got picked up by a number of news blogs and went viral. Within a few weeks, it had been watched more than a million times. Boyan found himself suddenly in the spotlight, a very big spotlight.
Yeah, the email form on the website was still linked to my personal mail account. So
it was bloated.
So I had to go through 500 emails a day of people who said, I want to help. How can I help? And then people were saying, you should get your ass on Kickstarter right now. So, so that's friendly advice that I then followed to start this first crowdfunding campaign and raise the first few million dollars to get started. So it was, those weeks were definitely overwhelming, but I think without that video having gone viral, we wouldn't be here talking to each other today.
No, that's another amazing moment, I think, that I've witnessed as well with some of the change makers, where at one moment when they start communicating their mission, their passion, their commitment to the cause, that can really drive a lot of traction, getting a lot of excitement, a lot of support, which obviously was one of those moments for you. Mm-hmm. So you said before that the garbage patches in the ocean can seem like an abstract problem. But when you see the amount of plastic coming back on the ships, I guess, it makes it very real, right? So what was that like for you for the first time when that happened? I don't know if it was with System 1 or System 2, maybe, when you could collect some garbage finally. You said, wow, I love that garbage.
Yeah, that was definitely System 2. System 1, we were happy with single pieces of plastic. Where we saw a few pieces of plastic in the system, we're like, yes, this is promising. Yeah. So a lot was at stake with that System 2, where it really had to work. If it wouldn't have worked,
would have been over.
I think it would have been over, honestly. So, but it did. And I remember this vividly. One morning I woke up and I saw I had all these missed phone calls and text messages. And I opened up my phone and there I saw it. I saw this photo of this mountain of plastic on the deck. And I've never been happier in my life.
I'm sure.
That moment for sure. That was a relief.
Have you kept one of those pieces of garbage as kind of a trophy in your place? This is the first piece of plastic I got.
We do
you have that?
We do
have
you
do? Okay.
I think one day we'll open up some kind of museum with...
Once
the garbage patch is gone, we need some kind of memory of it. And it's not just the first plastic, but also... Yeah. I mean, the objects that you pull out are sometimes extremely weird. We've seen toys, we've seen mannequins, we've seen we see all sort of languages. We occasionally find Wilson volleyballs, like in the movie Castaway.
So yeah, I remember that.
It's fun. It's like modern day archaeology out there.
It's a civilization memory, basically, right?
Exactly. On the sea. It's like all the way to the 1960s to the early 20th century.
In a film I saw about you, there's a shot of an exercise you do with your team. You show them a video of an autopsy on, I think, 4 turtles with plastic in their bodies. And I must say the images were pretty hard to watch. I could see the reactions of your team, right? The body's language and their faces when they heard the motivating message also after the video. You are not just cleaning up, you're actually saving lives. So aligning your team with the message, I think, was an incredible motivation for sure. And to keep hitting home those goal-oriented messages to basically reestablish the purpose of your mission all the time with your team. This is something I talked a lot about with some of my guests, including lately, actually, Ranji Gulati. Purpose beyond just a statement and embedding it into teams is actually a real work you have to do as a leader. So is the purpose statement something that resonates with you? How do you convey that deep sense of purpose with your team? And how do you go about doing that for the last 10 years of your life now?
What we're doing is hard, right? So, developing new technology, innovation is hard. Scaling a nonprofit is hard. So what we're doing requires a tremendous amount of effort and willpower and drive from everyone that we have on board. And I don't think I can pay people to give that level of motivation. Of course, you don't want people to worry about their mortgage and things like that. But at the same time, I think it's really this intrinsic motivation that is what draws people to work at the ocean cleanup. And also what keeps people working on these very challenging problems every day. So, and of course, there are moments when it feels like everything is against you and problems feel insurmountable. But I think it's important to, indeed, to keep reminding people why we do what we do, why it's worth all this pain, and also to remind people how we already went through so many roadblocks over the past 10 years. That gives us a lot of confidence that the next roadblock we encounter is also something we can overcome as a team.
And that tells, I'm sure, creating a lot of resiliency with the team as well, and a lot of gross mindset all the time, accepting failures and coming back again and trying hard again and again. You know what I've learned through my career at Microsoft, but also meeting with many, many different type of leaders, Boyan, for the last many years, is that you don't basically take a purpose as a given. You never do that. But you've got a chance as a leader to kind of help shaping a culture of an organization, which is, to me, the way you live the values, the way you do things, the way you actually make the toughest decisions when things are turning south, not going well. So how would you describe the ocean cleanup culture? What would it be to work for you, work in your team, in the ups and in the downs, of course, that we discussed before, right? System one, breaking, etc.
Yeah. So there are four pillars to our culture at the ocean cleanup. And we take this quite seriously in terms of both selecting people for cultural fit, as well as celebrating behaviors that we think are exemplary for that. And there's four pillars. So one is dedicated to the mission. So everyone at the ocean cleanup has some kind of connection to the ocean. Most people are either sailors or surfers or scuba divers. It's not a hard requirement that you do some kind of thing on the water, but
personal attachment to the coast, basically.
Exactly. Needs to feel some kind of personal mission. It's mission first. I think that's that kind of thing, right? There's no place for a-holes or egos. that you sometimes see in, you know, bigger companies, this kind of struggling for your own position. And I think that's, there's no room for that at the Ocean Cleanup. Then it's delivering impact. So and ultimately, you know, we don't want to be, you know, a typical organization where it's sort of about good intentions, but no results. So we are also very hard on the KPIs, on measuring our progress.
Okay.
So being pragmatic too. Being consequentialist, right? Thinking about the outcome very much first and foremost. Then it's about drive to improve. So you know, it's about learning by doing. It's about, you know, not analyzing things for years before we try things out. Yeah. So how can we keep our failures low cost and just try things out? And also having that the reflection, of course. So when we make mistakes, of course, you know, analyzing those properly. And then fourthly, the fourth pillar is doing together. So it's there's this natural tendency we've seen, which probably is not unique to our organization, but that you know, teams become their own small islands and their own silos. And I think you know, thinking beyond the interest of your team, but seeing the ocean cleanup as your team, even if you're working on, you know, rivers, you are also dependent on our success in the ocean, because I think if we fail there, that's going to have an impact on our overall credibility too. So it's you know, thinking as a, you know, with the interest of the ocean cleanup as a whole. I think that's our fourth pillar.
I love the way Bojan combines those four pillars of his organizational culture. Beating with that sense of purpose, do each member of the team is there personally, and connecting that to a dedication, to excellence, to hard work, to outcomes, to the test and learn. Because if you fail and feel horribly about it, and don't recover from that, then there's no point in being part of the team. And the way he brings his whole team together is super strong. On the podcast, I meet lots of change makers. And something I'm always interested in asking them about is how they secure their funding. Because it's something that is not always talked about, and yet it often takes up a lot of time, energy for the founders, and it's incredibly hard work. Bojan recently secured a $25 million donation from Airbnb co-founder Joe Gebbia, the largest private donation Ocean Cleanup has received to date. I wonder how Bojan had felt getting that cash injection and how it has changed things for the better.
Yeah, now Joe's a dear friend, and you know, his support has been exceptional. And yeah, we're all extremely thankful for that. The large donations, of course, have, you know, the largest impact, but at the same time, there's a huge group of smaller donations that we receive continuously. Yep. And I think just the letters we receive, the stories from school children that go for a run around school and raise money for us, I mean, those kind of things, we appreciate to essentially an equal level. And we have this wall in our kitchen at the office with all the, you know, the letters that we receive. You know, initially, when I started the Ocean Cleanup, I was thinking, yeah, should this be a company? Should this be a non-profit?
And you
know, I believe if something can be a company, you know, I think that's the way to go, right? Because if you can align you with the, you know, with market forces, if you can work within that, you know, things are a lot easier generally. Yes. You know, you can also have access to different types of funding, to the best people, et cetera, with, you know, different kinds of incentive models. But, you know, the conclusion was that, you know, the amount of R&D required to get to the point that it would work, and in combination with a very unclear prospect for there to be any kind of, you know, business model associated with this, just made it that I didn't see any other way than funding this development through donations. So that's why ultimately the Ocean Cleanup became a non-profit. But still, even though we are a non-profit, we do like to think as a any sort of for-profit startup
as a business.
Company. So the way we've treated the fundraising in the, you know, the earlier years was essentially as investment money. So we had these, you know, we treated these also as rounds, right? Where we had some objectives, we had a plan, we went to donors, we asked, okay, would you like to support this? Mm-hmm. And then they said, yes, okay, we could actually deliver, we can execute. And then based on those results, we could go back to them and to others to ask for money for, let's say, the next round. And I think, you know, a mistake many nonprofits make is that they consider donations as revenue instead of investment.
Investments.
Because I think it makes you complacent. And really, the way we treated these donations was as a way to get us to the next milestone rather than just as something that just keeps going forever. So I think that's the way we've gotten to where we are today. Now, when it comes to scaling, I do think we need different revenue models. But the good thing is, I think we will be creating a lot of value. And I think there are, you know, stakeholders there that are willing to pay for the creation of that value. There is now a big push internationally for national governments to act beyond their national jurisdiction to remediate the damage that has already been done. Currently, a United Nations plastic treaty is being negotiated. So our hope is that that will actually create the financial mechanisms to fund the cleanup of the ocean garbage patches. And then for rivers, there is a very selfish incentive for countries that emit a lot of plastic to tackle that, because most of the plastic ends up on their beaches and it ruins their tourism, their fisheries. Yeah. And beyond that, of course, you have companies that that can benefit from the value of being associated with that cleanup. So that's essentially the transition we hope to make in the next 2 years or so. Is instead of, I think philanthropy will still play an important role.
It would be a hybrid model, I guess, right? It would be a mixed model.
More between, in terms of a real exchange of value, just like you sell a product to a consumer, essentially.
Yeah. Maybe one day you're going to have a kind of a plastic offset platform as well. I'm not sure this is a good idea, by the way, like the carbon offset. But
I mean, we've been thinking about that. So I think it's tricky. And the cost of taking a piece of plastic out of the middle of the ocean is much higher than the cost of intercepting it on a parking lot, for example.
Right.
But the value is much greater because the stuff that's in the middle of the ocean will stay there for decades, while the thing on the parking lot will... 99% chance it doesn't even make it to the ocean, right? So, so it's unlike carbon, where a ton of CO2 is a ton of CO2.
Yeah.
With plastic, it's way more complicated. But those are the kind of questions we are looking into at the moment.
So I'd like you to go back, Brian, a little bit more on the three-pronged approach you've been developing to achieve your mission, right? I mean, first you talk about it. It's with System 3 now coming up, and some future innovations. You said, I think, that running out 10 of these larger systems in the near future could clean up to 80% of North Pacific plastic debris, right, by the end of the decade, which would be pretty amazing. Secondly, you carried some research in 2021 that suggests that 1,000 of the world's rivers are the source of 80% of the river-borne plastic contributing to global ocean plastic pollution. So now you are going upstream, indeed, to clean up the most polluted rivers in the world, so that you prevent them from getting to the oceans in the first place. You have actually started as well, going full circle by creating a revenue source with some products like sunglasses pairs made with the plastic waste retrieved from the ocean. And more ideas, as you suggested, to create some revenue sources for the future. So can you take us through the impact you are getting now on the river upstream? And all this new circular revenue model as well, you think, and maybe there might be different sources, will contribute to some additional funding to actually accelerate the resolution of the problem that you talked about.
So if we don't stop more plastic from reaching the oceans, obviously we would have to keep cleaning forever, and that's in nobody's interest. So, and in fact, at the Ocean Cleanup, we make it pretty explicit that we want to help ourselves out of business. We don't want to exist in... 10, 20 years from now. Of course, there are some nonprofits. I mean, I was listening to your podcast with Sal Khan. I mean, that's a different kind of nonprofit, and I hope he continues to exist forever.
education accessible to all. Yes, that's a pretty big mission, a limited mission.
But in our case, it's slightly different, where we actually, you know, we think this is sort of a one-time thing we need to do. And then we want to get this over. If we still are cleaning the ocean 20 years from now, we will have failed, essentially. So in order to achieve that, the question is, or the question we asked ourselves is, you know, how do we stop the inflow of plastic into the oceans as quickly and as cost-effectively as possible? And then what we realized were two very important statistics. Firstly, we found that just a very tiny fraction of all the plastic that's been used actually flows into the ocean. So 400 million tons is produced every year. About 1 million tons or even less is flowing into the ocean. So that's just 0.25% of all the plastic. So, and where it flows into the ocean, where it's that 0.25%, those are rivers. And then what we found out next by developing AI-powered cameras that we attach to bridges to measure how much plastic is flowing out of these rivers, we found that just 1% of the world's rivers emits about 80% of all the plastic that goes into the ocean. It's still about 1,000 rivers, so it's still, you know, it's not easy. It's not 10 rivers or something, but at least it's achievable. So to address this river leakage, we developed something we call interceptors, which are systems that we put in the mouths of those rivers, and they capture the plastic before it enters the oceans. So right now we have them in 12 rivers around the world. We hope to be at 20 by early next year. And then once we have 20, we think that's the foundation based on which we can then start scaling to those 1,000 rivers. And we just deployed a new interceptor in one of the heaviest polluting rivers in the world, in Guatemala, where thanks to that one river, we have now extracted more plastic this quarter than in all previous years combined.
The interceptor Boyan recently got going is trying to halt a plastic tsunami in the Rio Motaga, the largest river in Guatemala. The pollution a river creates is off the chart. It's responsible for an estimated 2% of global plastics emissions into the oceans, which is huge. Boyan and his team are currently taking up to 44 dump trucks of trash out of the river every day. Every day. And is the Guatemalan government actually funding you to do that? Because it's like, okay, that's actually a big deal.
They're not funding us yet. So if you're listening, please get in touch. No, but we are working closely together with them, of course, on the permits, on operational matters. Yeah. And of course, I think it's up to us first to really demonstrate the efficacy, the performance. Yeah. I think if we really have solved this river, if we solve this problem, I think that's indeed a good conversation to have, to say, okay, now it's your turn to take over the operations.
And I'm sure this is where you can also, I'm sure you're probably doing that, right? So partnering with international governmentalization, multilateralization like UN and others, right? To help you having this multiple touch in multiple countries in the world.
Yeah, so earlier this year, we signed a partnership with the UNDP, the United Nations Development Programme, who are now essentially our first foot in the door whenever we enter a new country. So obviously, they're a massive network. They're in all these places. And so they help us with getting started when we enter a new country. And and they also complement our work by using us as a catalyst to tackle further upstream changes. So they work with the government to improve waste management, to improve education, essentially on the back of that interceptor. Because when an interceptor arrives in a city, that's it's like an ornament, right? It's a it's a very visible thing that everyone talks about. That's a great place to start the conversation on these further upstream things. Yeah,
no, that's pretty amazing. Could you touch very quickly on this third pillar? I briefly mentioned my question, right? The sunglasses and other objects made of recycled plastic.
So to solve this problem, we need to clean up the legacy pollution in the ocean. We need to stop more from going in. But then we also need to deal with all that plastic that we pull out of the world's oceans and rivers. And on one hand, of course, it's our job to make sure that it doesn't end up back in the environment. But secondly, we actually think that because there is such a powerful story attached to this material, that there is value in that material.
Yeah.
And in fact, we see a lot of demand from companies to actually buy that material, to use it to create durable, sustainable products. So indeed, a few years ago, we launched these sunglasses. They're very premium, $200 sunglasses. We sold them out quickly, 25,000 pieces. Of course, the amount of plastic we take out is so fast, we can't turn it all into sunglasses, but it was really a proof of concept to show you can make beautiful things out of this material. So the next step is to partner with big multinational companies to integrate our material into their product. So
the first
company that has come in now is Kia. So hopefully soon in their electric cars, we're going to see some of our material.
Super.
And we're definitely in conversation with others too, which hopefully reduces the overall cost of the cleaner.
So do you think that eventually you'll be able to make a systems change by creating a movement involving all the stakeholders, changing policies, changing behavior as well, which is a bigger mission, harder, so that 10 years from now, or maybe even before, our oceans and rivers will be plastic free? Can you envision that actually?
Yeah, so with the things that we do, if we are successful with our mission to clean up the garbage patches, to clean up or to intercept in all these polluting rivers, I think that alone will be enough for us to return to clean oceans in about a decade from now. At the same time, what I hope is that what we do will spark and inspire others to work on the further upstream changes, because plastic in the ocean is one thing, it's where plastic is most harmful, but there are other issues with plastic too. And I think beyond that, there are of course many other issues that I think can be solved through entrepreneurship and technology. So I think in a broader sense, what I do hope is that the Ocean Clip can be an example on how to solve problems, not by pointing fingers or by complaining or by saying no to everything, but rather to say to say yes to innovation, to entrepreneurship, and to roll up your sleeve and get to work.
I'm 100% with Boy on this one. Through my work here with Microsoft and through my foundation, I'm so much into supporting the yes generation as opposed to the naysayers, helping individuals and organizations anticipate and shape the skill they will need in the future to work together on comprehensive solutions to the biggest societal problems. Boyens is just a great example of how much each one of us can achieve. And he had some particularly powerful reflections on the responsibility of technologists and engineers to spend their time on something that helps the world rather than making it worse.
When I think about the destiny of where we are heading as a civilization, civilization is essentially a product of our technology, of the society that we build, which is a technical society. And ultimately, to develop new technology, you need two things, right? You need money and you need smart people. You need engineers, scientists, etc. And what strikes me is, for example, in the debate between fossil energy versus clean energy sources, how we want to move to the new kind of energy sources, obviously. I think a lot of emphasis is put on the money side of things, to talk about divestment of fossil fuel technology and industries. But I think equally important, if not more important, is how the world's smart engineers, where they choose to spend their time. And I don't know whether every engineer realizes how much power they have by choosing where they work on, whether they choose to work on the good technology or the bad technology. And when you think of the medical profession, of course, doctors have a big responsibility I think there's an analogy there where engineers have a huge responsibility too. And doctors, they get taught about ethics. They get taught, they have to give the Hippocratic Oath. And I just wonder, should we actually have sort of a Hippocratic Oath for engineers too? To commit to using their time, to using their intelligence to help the world rather than make it worse.
I love that. I think it is very much in line with, I think, a strong, if not movement, a strong incentive and push through technology, particularly, I would say, cloud and AI these days that you know well, to drive and govern what is called responsible AI and make sure that... as we, technology companies and others, I mean, there's tons of companies developing technologies, we can apply the right development frameworks, the right inclusive manner as well to actually create technology that is driving positive outcomes for the people on the planet as opposed to negatives and make sure we prevent that from happening. Sounds to me like almost like engineering for good.
Exactly. I mean, there's, if you... listen to people like Toby Ort and Nick Bostrom, and they actually put a pretty high percentage on in terms of the probability of all of our lives ending this century based on misaligned artificial intelligence. And even 0.1% risk is unacceptably high, right? I mean, that's the background rate of me dying this year is about 0.1%. So if you think about that, you just you significantly elevate just that risk based on just AI development. And so, my future and all of our futures in part depends on the choices that engineers make today in companies like the one you work for. And I sincerely hope that we do make these choices in a careful and considered way.
Let me ask you a couple of last questions. I'd like to go back to the way you actually maintain for the last decade and more your physical, mental energy and positive mindset. You've got to be positive every day when you wake up, when you don't catch any plastic for years, right? And you start catching a little bit of plastic and then you start having some momentum. So how do you actually manage your positive energy in yourself to keep driving the mission and embark many more people surrounding you?
So in terms of how I manage my life, the key word there, I think, is routines. Firstly, it frees up mental space so that you don't have to think about just maintaining the basics. You can spend all that mental energy on being creative.
Yep.
And then secondly, by through these routines, you essentially reduce the amount of effort you need to spend to do that. So, for example, when I was, I think about 15 or 16, I decided, okay, I probably need to do some sports to keep myself healthy and maximize my lifespan. So I thought, okay, maybe I should start running. And actually, since then, there has not been a single week that I skipped doing my weekend run. So it's... And sometimes it's just 5K or something. Sometimes it's just a short run. But I think the consistency, for me, I don't ask myself the question, will I go for a run or not? It's just
go.
It's there's no choice. Once it's a routine, I kind of tend to stick to that. So I think it's about the things that you don't like to do that you have to do to just maintain good quality of your mental and physical health. You kind of want to... You want to limit the cognitive load required to do those things, and you want to, be as sort of exciting and varied as possible with all the other things in your life.
And beyond running, would you have some other routines like, I don't know, deep breathing or yoga or meditation or just pose, maybe just walking off the office and just getting your head like you clean up as well?
Yeah. So I tend to start my days with cold showers. And then before I sleep, just to kind of get my mind out of the problems I'm working on, I tend to read books for about an hour.
I think it's a great summary, and we had such examples in different other podcast episodes, Brian. Now, I'd like to finish, of course, with the you know, the last question and the last destination for you in many ways, because it's very clear to me listening to you, Bojan, that you're going to make it, meaning you're going to really eradicate plastic waste in the ocean rivers. I mean, what are you going to do next when all that garbage is off the oceans? Mm. What are you going to do next? What is Bojan's next mission?
Yeah. I think I have a list of about 100 ideas. What I could
100
do next.
Ideas. Okay. What is at the top of the list, the top 2-3, if you can share?
I prefer not to actually also
okay.
because
okay. Okay.
I wouldn't be able to now. I kind of erased them from my mind because you know this probably, you know, when you have an idea in your head, it just spreads around and it
becomes obsessive.
Stop thinking about it. Yeah, yeah. So I need to protect myself from my next obsession because I think I can't do those future things if the ocean cleanup hasn't been successful. So first this thing, and then I think, you know, a few years down the line, hopefully I will get the opportunity to work on more things.
By the way, I think it's not only it's fair, Bojan, it's actually the right decision. I'm with you. You can have one obsession and kind of one love at the same time, right? And if you want to give the very best of you, I mean, I think you have to give it all, right? And otherwise your mind is going to start, you know, running and driving you.
I mean, there are entrepreneurs who have been able to do multiple things at the same time. And of course, Elon Musk, Jack Dorsey. But
some do. Yeah.
Definitely, it's definitely too early for that. Like the ocean cleanup still needs my full attention at the moment.
It was a huge pleasure to discuss with Bojan, to delve into these ideas and to find out more about how he's driving his mission as a leader day by day through his team and organization. And I'm looking forward to seeing all the things he can achieve in the near and the long-term future. Talking to him actually left me feeling really energized and excited about our ability as a society to tackle those big environmental and social issues. You've been listening to the Positive Leadership Podcast with me, Jean-Philippe Courtois. Who would you like to hear on the show? If you've got suggestions for inspiring, purpose-led leaders you'd like me to speak to, well, let's get in touch on LinkedIn or Twitter. I'm always interested in your suggestions. And if you've enjoyed today's episode, please do leave us a comment, a rating, and share it with your friends. It really helps and makes an enormous difference. If you'd like more practical tips and advice on how to improve your positive leadership practice, to grow as an individual, a leader, and a global citizen, well, just subscribe to my monthly newsletter, Positive Leadership and You. It's over on my LinkedIn page. That's it. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.